BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Tan Chung Han.
Good morning.
It's Thursday, the 15th of March, 2018. And we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of stories, news and analysis, and some interviews as well, right? So quite an exciting day ahead of us. Perhaps time to review some news that happened overnight, or was reported overnight, rather. We, of course, have coming up this weekend, Bali celebrates its New Year, Han.
Mm. And indeed, what's going to be interesting about the celebrations this year is that Bali has actually asked phone companies there to switch off mobile internet. Now, some crucial services will still be there, and I say, for example, like hospitals, banking, etc. But for the general populace, no mobile internet.
Okay, so the question is why? This goes back to the fact that Bali, because is mostly populated by Hindus, so Bali, Indonesian Hindus, and it was the head of the Hinduism Society who kind of, I think it seems from the story, proposed this idea. He says their New Year is called Nyepi. Nyepi sounds like the Malay word for Sapi. Sapi, in silence, right? So in fact, it is the day of silence. That's the Hindu New Year in Bali. And what they're saying is that that the celebrations ought to focus on being introspective. Rather than looking at your gadgets and looking out into the world, you should look inwards. I thought that was very interesting because we often celebrate New Year with raucous and, you know,
spectacles.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So it's very raucous. Now, also in the news, the Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte says that he plans to withdraw his country from the International Criminal Court after it began examining his country's drug wars.
Yeah, so Duterte is claiming that the ICC is being used as a political tool against the Philippines, and he says the attacks by the UN are baseless. Those are his words. We have seen this drug war playing out in the Philippines, although official government numbers of the death tolls appear to some to underestimate the actual number dead.
Right, so it's drug wars, or war against not only drug pushers, but also drug addicts. So people with problems with substance are now being treated as criminals. And Duterte, because, you know, always want to not be too, you know, you could say he's a bit tone deaf, right? So he put it out, well, Hitler killed so many Jews, millions of Jews, he says, you know, and they're drug addicts and, you know, maybe they should be killed too. So he, because of his own sort of perhaps
the lens that he's using.
I think a lens is a good word, I think. So it's a slightly jaundiced lens that he has on the question of people with problems around drugs. I mean, not just the drug pushers, but also those who take it. He's pushing. So he wants to silence the International Criminal Court. And finally, silenced is Stephen Hawking, dead at 76, because well-known astrophysicist, never won a Nobel Prize, but of course has shaped the global conversation around science.
And certainly a man who has pushed those conversations into the realm of pop culture as well, given his numerous references, either via sitcoms like The Simpsons or his appearance on Big Bang Theory.
Weibo. He became a member of Weibo and got instantly millions of fans. Now, just to quote him, as a man who's shuffled off this mortal coil, talking about a God and the afterlife, he says, "I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components failed. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark." Stephen Hawking's entering into the dark, finally. We'll be back with a look at real life traumas on celluloid. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Tan Chung Han. And that was Beginning to See the Light by Velvet Underground, a 1969 hit. Beginning to See the Light, we were talking about Stephen Hawking's passing just now. He, of course, has entered into the dark.
And not necessarily believing in an afterlife.
Well, he definitely didn't. He was an atheist.
Right.
Okay. Speaking about a darkness, you know, there are many moments in our lives and also our national history countries that constitute darkness, a trauma, you can call it, national trauma. And for Norway, the national trauma, at least one recent one, happened in July 2011 with a mass shooting at a Norwegian Labour Party youth camp. The shooting took the lives of 69 teenagers and dozens of others, of course, injured. Also, there was a bomb blast in the capital city of Oslo, killing 8 people. So all in all, over 70 people were killed by the right-wing extremist Anders Breivik. Mm. Now a movie is being made of that moment. Is it too soon?
Well, that is obviously a very, very loaded question. And it's, you know, subject to the various stakeholders. And from what I gather from this article here, the filmmaker actually went about speaking to all those who were involved, not just the survivors, but also their parents and also the authorities, you know, even to the extent of engaging the folks who were on that island as well. And so, yeah, I guess it's all relative. This filmmaker saw pushback in making this movie. But in the end, I guess the mission was to ensure that this dark episode remains in the collective memory via this movie.
Yeah, and that's, of course, you know, if you look at Malaysia, we've had our dark moments as well. May 13th, of course, springs to mind immediately. And there are many ways in which May 13 has entered either popular culture or, more serious expressions in literary form or even in paintings. And then you go to Indonesia and, a look at what happened there in 65 with the mass killings of members of the Communist Party by right-wingers, the military, as well as Islamic groups. So, and in Indonesia, it's a much more tricky thing, as I understand it. If you remember the work of Oppenheimer, the filmmaker, around, the 65 trauma. But coming back to Malaysia, have been moments that are also difficult. People say, well, do we really want to revisit the May 13th?
Right. For example, even MH370, just to bring something into the more recent past, right? Questions about whether that should be turned into a movie. And, I think reading the accounts for many of those who may have lost loved ones, they push back against the idea, saying that why should our personal hell, right? Why should our tragedy be made into this form of popular entertainment, right?
So, well, entertainment's a funny word to use, right? Because it's not about ha ha he he entertainment. It's about, well, I haven't seen the movie, but possibly it will be about thinking deeply about an issue, right? So that, again, that process of introspection that the Balinese want for their new year, perhaps you can have through serious film. But even if it's not serious, and this is where it gets more problematic, when something of a trauma becomes the background, a background that's not taken, for something maybe a bit more humorous, and that might be a problem.
Or sometimes when filmmakers perhaps take creative liberties and do not stick to what actually transpired in that tragedy.
Well, that's what you want. I mean, you want literature to take creative, to have creative license and to have, a poetic license and all those expressions we use, because you want them to elevate the moment, right?
Yeah,
so if not, then what you have is a news report. A documentary.
Right.
But a feature film is supposed to elevate it. It's supposed to, understand or crystallize the essence of that moment, not necessarily report the facts.
Sure, but from that one single tragedy, multiple narratives can be spun out of it, right? So, there are opportunity costs as well. So some people, for example, with this Norwegian tragedy, say it should be focused on the downfall or the consequences of extreme ideology, for example. Others want a true account of what actually happened on the island. Others want to talk about, say, focusing on the survivors. So there's so many competing narratives there. I don't envy the filmmaker in being put in that position, but I certainly admire his resilience and his courage in actually putting this movie out.
Okay, resilience and courage in admitting your faults. That's what we're going to be talking about next. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, and that was the 80s British alternative rock band, The Wonder Stuff, and their song, Don't Let Me Down Gently. sorry, excuse me. You know Dylan Thomas, the poet, you know, and his poem, Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night?
Oh, okay, I know of the poem, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, Dylan Thomas, there he is, a Welsh poet. And of course, his song that really exemplified a particular sentiment around death, you know, kind of refusing what death does, which is to silence and take away people that we love. So, yeah, part of them. The happy mood we've had this morning.
Yeah, some pretty heavy topics we're covering at 6 a.m. You know, but I mean, at the same time, I think that these are rather poignant questions, and you know, something that I guess if 6 a.m. isn't a good time, then there's no good time then to contemplate.
You know, the thing about
things.
Stephen Hawking, and because it's the occasion for a lot of discussions about death, is that he was told that he was going to live a very short life when he was only 21. Mm. He lived to 76. Now that is an extraordinary reason to celebrate. In fact, celebrate a life well lived.
Yeah, talk about defying the odds, not just in terms of, you know, how long he lived, but also the amount that he was able to accomplish given his physical disabilities.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mind over matter in that instance. Now, National Geographic, is that a magazine that's had a place in your heart, Han? It has in mine.
Yes.
But recently, they came to admit that they had a racist past. And this is a magazine that was established, I believe, in the late 19th century. So it's not unthinkable that they would reflect the attitudes of that time, at least in the West, which had developed at that point quite a racist ideology, especially as it colonized much of the world.
Right. So the catalyst for this introspection on the part of National Geographic was its April edition. So it's dedicated to race, the April edition of National Geographic. And so as part of that edition, they asked a historian to look at past issues as it decided to, I guess, re-examine its coverage to mark 50 years since the passing of Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King.
You know, what's really interesting is that we in Malaysia use the concept race very loosely. We talk about different racial groups. But in fact, from a scientific point of view, there is only one race. It's the human race. And what we are really talking about is ethnicity, language differences, phenotype differences, meaning phenotype meaning the shape of your face, the color of your skin. That's not race, but that's what race has become in Malaysia, and we use it in a very indisciplined way.
Well, nevertheless, I think also being cognizant of the fact, well, not a fact, but this idea that racism is a social construct and more so than a biological one.
It is not a biological one. Right, there's no basis. But it used to be a popular idea, and a lot of anthropologists, a field that I studied, you know, started off trying to prove race theory, and then, of course, finally it was debunked. But coming back to National Geographic, and, you know, what is the meaning of this kind of admission? What is this confession, this gesture of, you know, an apology really mean? And we turned to Cam Razlan, the host of BFM's A Bit of Culture show, and asked him for his thoughts on National Geographic's admission. We asked him his views about how we should look at National Geographic coverage in the light of today's sensibilities.
Well, it's actually one of the key kind of cultural conundrums of our time is how we look back now on the documents that either we ourselves or our parents or grandparents grew up with. And how do we judge that in the light of today? Yes, we'd say, it's incredibly racist. I think it was National Geographic, or certainly Smithsonian expeditions to, say, the Kalahari, where they would bring back Bushmen and they would put them in a pen in the museum in New York, and they would be viewed as essentially wild animals. But that was exploration in those days. It was to go and kill, capture, and or give syphilis to everything they saw. I think National Geographic, they had the camera. They were the first people to go with the camera. And then that became the trophy, the photograph. So it was enlightening to see the other. And it's crazy because, you know, Malaysia, we, all of us here in Malaysia, were the other from the New York's National Geographic perspective. But I think we need to keep these documents as historical documents and to look back on them in a way without judgment. We have different value systems now, but by looking at those documents, you can see artifacts of what life was like in the late 19th century in, say, Africa. And also we have an artifact now of what American and European attitudes were to those other. So I don't think we can demand that the world back then was as we would like it to be now.
And that was Cam Ruslan, host of A Bit of Culture on BFM.
And I like that phrase that Cam Ruslan used, right? Looking back without judgment. Like, how far back do you extend that leniency or that grace, right? Because, look, society values, norms, these are constantly evolving things, right? And so, you know, do we extend those, the kind of the same levels of leniency on, say, politicians or authority figures in society? I mean, if the National Geographic, with all its resources and all its influence on, you know, our Western thinking, at least back then, right? If they could be susceptible to those kinds of thinking, right, racist thinkings and whatnot, so, you know,
they were in fact the main purveyors of it. Well, the main purveyors of it, in some ways, they maintain the ideology. But if you talk about leniency, often we can't go back to the editor who in 1916 had a caption that was racist, you know, with photographs of people from, you know, natives of, say, Australia, for, you know, and that's one of the instances in that article. But because that editor no longer exists, but we had a recent case of a man who was, as a young person, as a 21-year-old, a guard at Auschwitz, you know, and he was still being, and he was dragged through the court system and was charged and convicted for his complicity at a very young age, at a time that was deeply racist and, you know, was formed by a fascist ideology.
Right,
you
know, so again,
so we do take people to task for attitudes that have, were, you know, from an older time.
Mm.
Well, we're running out of time, in fact. We're coming up to the first bulletin of the morning. This conversation will continue. Taking us there to the first bulletin is The Doors with Roadhouse Blues. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was The Cure and their 1984 hit, Boys Don't Cry. Because lots of boys and girls are crying at the death of Stephen Hawking. He died at the ripe old age of 76, having been told in his early 20s that he didn't have much time to live. He is probably one of the best known scientists worldwide, and his theoretical physics and his work in theoretical physics on black holes in particular transformed how scientists think about the nature of the universe. But why did he appeal to people who weren't in the scientific community, to people possibly like you and me, Han?
Well, I think because of his many appearances via pop cultural mediums, you know, his likeness was used in some episodes on The Simpsons. He was on The Big Bang Theory, obviously some movies as well. So he was there. He was present in popular culture. So that helped it as well.
You know, there are, of course, you know, astrophysicists, you know, and I think it's probably maybe the nature of what they are that, you know, that they also become public intellectuals. And I mentioned earlier, the very famous Chinese astrophysicist Fang Lizhi, you know, who, one of his books was Bringing Down the Wall, which is a book I read, you know, 20 years ago when he became seen by Beijing as the mastermind of the Tiananmen protests by students. And he really did shape, you know, Chinese worldviews, at least for the youth of that time. He, of course, I don't know if he's much remembered in China. He passed away in the US, having gone into exile.
Right. And also speaking about the Chinese values, you know, there's this story about how, you know, because of Stephen Hawking's achievements, you know, punching above his weight, overcoming the odds, you know, that story and that virtue resonates totally with the Chinese population. That's why he's so revered over there, you know? And that's why he's got, like you mentioned earlier, how many million followers on Weibo?
Oh, he had millions. Yeah. I mean, in hours. When he first joined in 2016 or something, he got millions of followers.
Right, so, you know, having these scientists who break out beyond the boundaries of their fraternity, like Neil deGrasse Tyson as well, another one, right, who's constantly out there.
Or Carl Sagan, great communicators from the scientific community. Now we turn to astrophysicist Dr. Mazlan Othman, a Malaysian, and also director of the International Council of Science, a regional office for Asia Pacific, and asked of her thoughts on Stephen Hawking. Hawking's impact on her.
I'm very, very sad, of course, because he has had a lot of impact on me as an astrophysicist and also on the work that I do, which is mainly related to public outreach. He punches above his weight in terms of his reach to the public, you know. he never won a Nobel Prize, but what is important is how science is communicated to the public, and he had it down to a pat, you know, with his book, A Brief History of Time. You know, it was on the bestsellers list for many, many years. And cannot imagine any scientific book like that would stay so long on the bestsellers list. But that's Stephen Hawking for you.
We also asked Dr. Mazlan what his biggest contributions to science were.
One of his biggest contributions was about his theory on black holes. Before his theory, everyone thought black holes would last forever, and he came up with the idea that black holes finally die. They, like every other thing, they fade away. And this was a new idea at that time. And this was in keeping with Einstein's theory of relativity. Some scientists, serious scientists, find him overrated simply because the public interest was too high. But I don't think that that is a very good way of looking at a person's contribution. It's not about Nobel Prize, but you may win the Nobel Prize and never make any impact on society. And having an impact on society, inspiring young people, inspiring scientists, and getting people curious. So people, when they read his book, they don't understand everything, but it didn't matter, or it doesn't matter. People will still try to plow through his book and become curious. And I think that is what is important.
That was Malaysian astrophysicist Dr. Mazlan Othman speaking about the impact that Stephen Hawking had on her and her career. Very interesting, of course, you know, Han, you know, for some of us, I don't know how, were you a person that was really taken by science and issues around science?
Yeah, I'm not someone who naturally gravitated towards black holes and the like. You see what I did there? So again, not too familiar with his work. I don't...
You're very good at the puns, though.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, okay. I don't think I've ever gone to a bookstore and said, hey, let me go pick up A Brief History of Time. But I certainly know who Stephen Hawking is.
You know, in my time, we had Carl Sagan, of course, Cosmos, which was a very popular television series. We also had, if you remember, you know, there was a dramatization through a documentary form of Einstein's theory of relativity. When I was in university, I tried to read the general theory because, was it the specific theory? But anyway, there's two theories of relativity. And I kind of tell them apart. But the thing was shocking to me was it said in the introduction, you know, if you're an undergraduate, you should be able to understand this book. And I found it impossible. Absolutely impossible.
All my generation had was Bill Nye, the science guy.
Okay, well, tell us, you know, what Stephen Hawking means to you or doesn't mean to you. You can always WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Leave your name so we know who you are and join this conversation. Also on Twitter at BFM Radio. We'll be back with more on Stephen Hawking. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was David Bowie with Starman. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or following us on Twitter and responding to tweets there. We're still talking about the late Stephen Hawking, passed away yesterday at the age of 76. Stellar scientist and great communicator. The question is, there's been a lot of stuff about science. Are people really attracted to it, though?
Yeah, well, I was just reading this foreword in Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, which was actually written by Carl Sagan. And it talks about how, you know, often the inquisitive nature of science and all that, more often than not, poses more questions than answers. And so it exposes the limitations of the human mind. And that's why perhaps so many people shy away from it, right?
But, you know, and also are attracted to it. And I think a particular kind of person is attracted to open-ended discussions, those without definitive answers. Yeah, and, you know, this is why a lot of scientists are often, I mean, not necessarily, but are atheists, you know, who are not afraid of the fact that when we get snuffed out as you know, or as our computer components in our computer fail and we die, you know, computers don't go over to the other side. They just remain in a junkyard.
Right, and now while Hawking may be an atheist, as you pointed out earlier in the show, Sagan writes this, and I quote, "Hawking is attempting, as he explicitly states, to understand the mind of God.
Oh, right. So the expression, and this was controversial, but when he said it, he had to explain later that he didn't mean a personal God, a God that you can communicate with, which a lot of religious traditions have. He said it was an impersonal God. What people use, the code is God, but for what he calls the laws of physics. So very clear that he said he was not to be taken literally.
Right.
He meant it in a figurative sense, but because people like to be literal. I mean, it's just the nature of things. Now, talking about science education and whether science is accessible to everybody, we spoke to Fabien Bouheye, who's the founder of PublicSci, a platform that aims to make science accessible to everyone. We asked him why so many people are taken by Hawking's work.
He definitely did, you know, and he was one of the person as well that was not trying to break it down too much, because there's some concepts of science that you can't just, you know, put in layman's term to make it understandable. But he did romanticize the language, and every time you were reading these books, you can actually picture things. And you know, the arts has always been a wonderful medium to convey messages, especially around science. And he was really good at taking us on those beautiful journeys that, you know, will make us wonder about the secrets of the universe, you know. And I think we'll miss that very much.
We also asked Fabien whether Stephen Hawking was able to make science accessible beyond what he'd done with his books.
You know, I think he really did embark on that journey very much like Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson more recently to make that knowledge accessible to everybody. And he did really much contribute to that by writing the, you know, Brief History of Time and all the appearances that he did, you know, in colleges and universities and on TV to bring that knowledge to the people. And he had an incredible sense of humor as well. You know, he had a few interviews with John Oliver, but, you know, you end up having a laugh. And it's not every day that you can actually watch scientific content and be entertained at the same time. So I think in his way, he was just an incredible contributor of the scientific knowledge to the people.
That was Fabien Bouheye, the founder of PublicSci, a platform that aims to make science accessible to everyone. You know, and what's also extraordinary about, you know, Stephen Hawking, of course, is the fact that he was quadriplegic for much part of his life. Mm. You know, he and eventually his voice wasn't even his. It was artificially created. And that in today's world where we're so taken by surfaces, by appearances, that people have to be beautiful to be able to communicate. People have to be conventional in their beauty to communicate.
Right. But, you know, he was obviously very willing to embrace that and poke fun of that during his numerous public appearances, right? And I think there was a cartoon, too bad this is radio, but there's a cartoon, Sharad, that you shared with us earlier this morning with Chinese characters, you know, kind of written above this empty wheelchair. And also, so often we see Stephen Hawking because of his physical disabilities, but also we perhaps pay less mind to actually the work that he's actually accomplished, right? Because it's so, I mean, science often feels so detached from everyday life, right? But
physics is all around us, isn't
exactly,
it?
And Hawking's makes it accessible.
Okay. We'll be coming up to the next Bulletin of the Morning, and then we'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.